Hello and welcome back to Unseen Incidents. It's me, your host, Patrick Vance Charton, and on this week's episodes, we ask whether there's value in old players on the transfer market and which old players could be worth picking up. Then we open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we run through some of the biggest moves of the summer so far, asking whether we agree with Arsenal, Chelsea and Manchester United's business. And then we bring you the normal nonsense in anything but football. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back after a prolonged absence. Pete Dorman, good to see you, man. How are you doing?
Hello, hello, hello. Good to see you too. I'm well, Patrick. How are you? Good to see you.
I'm good.
It's been a minute. It's been three weeks.
It's been a long time.
Maybe four. I don't know. We've both been on holidays that dovetailed in awkward ways.
Yeah.
But, you know, blessing and a curse in that it's given us a prolonged break.
Yeah. And in theory, we should come back refreshed.
Well, yes. It's very astute observation, Patrick.
I don't know about you, but I'm not refreshed.
Well, So this was our first holiday away with the child. And I remember your pessimism at my enjoyment of it.
I tried to tamp it down.
Yeah, absolutely did not. You basically were like, good luck with that. That's not how it's going to work. And you were right in part, but not exclusively. Because it was actually generally kind of fine. We just had to shift how we holiday, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We were having dinner at like 7. But at least so we drove down France for the first week and then stayed at the house for the second week. So the second week was kind of just more normal life because we would just put the baby down at like 7 p.m, 8 p.m. French time actually. Once she was down, we would then just like barbecue out in the courtyard of the house. And
sure.
The baby monitor, and basically if the baby woke up, you'd go up. It's the same, we would have dinner at home. And we had friends there and that was nice. So that was kind of normal. What changed was like we were basically having lunches and out all day. And then having like a really early dinner at like 6:30, trying to be finished for like 7:30. Basically like in and out, mains only, no fucking about, half bottles of wine. Because we were basically playing with fire as to when, because when Bonnie would have been done and started kicking off, like she's done, she's like, we need to take her to bed. Like she's not going to stop screaming until she gets fed and gets put to sleep, basically. So that was kind of the biggest hurdle to navigate, but that was like largely fine. But I guess with the driving and with all of the other stuff, and then with this, we were the first people out to the house, which mm-hmm. meant that like we basically had to open the house up for summer, which required like a load of like grass cutting, pressure washing, all of random chores that you kind of don't expect to have to do on holiday. So I said to my friend who was out there with us, we left on the Friday to drive home, getting the shuttle on Saturday. By the like Wednesday in our second mm-hmm. week, I was like, okay, I'm finally starting to feel relaxed and we're going home in 2 days. So I got like 24 to 36 hours of relaxation, and then it got to like the Thursday evening where I'm like, right, now I've got to think about everything about getting home for Thursday mm-hmm. afternoon and like closing up the house and all of that stuff. So yeah, I got a solid 24 hour window of relaxed holiday mode on a 2 week holiday. But how was your trip to Spain?
I mean, like the time when I was rested, what you're describing, you know, I'm not convinced that did arrive.
You're still waiting for it?
Exactly. How do I describe it? It was fine. But I think the thing about going with like in-laws and stuff is that you are on holiday, but you are watching somebody else have a much better holiday than you.
Sure.
And they were relaxing and like having a swim and then having a cocktail and then like reading a book. And I was like, it's too hot now. I need to take my kids into the air conditioned room and we'll read some books for a bit, or like, you know, play in some other way.
Yeah.
And then we can go out in the pool. Like it was a little bit of a difficult one, this one. Like I often think as well that, you know, when you've got kids, the difference between it being like quite hot and being very hot suddenly becomes like a real problem. So, like, we couldn't really be outside that much if we weren't in the pool because it was so hot.
Oh, and you got caught in that heat wave as well, I assume?
Yeah. And kids, we were. And kids are, like, you know, not great at drinking, like, stuff like that. So it's always, like, a little bit complicated. Plus, there's the thing. You know when people say, wouldn't you want to go to the Maldives? And you're like, yeah, that sounds...
Well, because no kids are allowed.
That sounds fine, but no, because I'm going to have a nice time.
Sure.
But then it's going to, the journey home is going to take so long that by the time I get home, I will not be rested anymore.
Sure.
I will be tired from doing like 26 hours of travel or whatever it is, you know? And I do feel the same way about traveling with children. Like, you get back from your like day of travel at the end, and even if you were rested, which I was not, by the end of that day, you're like Emma and I looked at each other, even Emma's normally more positive about this stuff than I am, but we looked at each other at the end of that day of travel and we were like, we can't do it like this again.
Yeah.
Cause like car to plane to train.
It's a lot.
45 minutes into like a 10 hour day of travel, both children have been sick.
Love it.
So I was
ideal
like,
start.
This is fucked.
To be fair,
they're pretty good. They were very good after that. But
yeah,
like,
well, I mean, you can't get much worse than that within the first hour.
Well, yeah. And like, I had a bag for Coco. So she was just sick in a bag. Whereas like Goldie literally had to be like stripped off.
Love it. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's not tip top, but at least you start with the worst one. Like car, I find with children worst. Then plane, then train. Train is always fine. So like, every successive stage that I think
it was progressive,
they felt a bit better. But I don't know, like, being totally honest with you, I came back and I was just like, I'm fucking knackered. Like, I need a rest, bro.
Yeah.
Like,
I think you messaged me in the, like, after we got home being like, how you been? How's your holiday? And I responded and I asked you the same thing. And I think in that text you said you had a good time, but I think at the end of that text was, we won't be doing it again.
Yeah, I think that's that remains my abiding feeling.
So I think that us being able to drive was obviously for me, doing all the driving, it was like somewhat taxing, but it was fine. French roads are actually great. They're expensive, but they're great.
Mm-hmm.
But the luxury was that we made our own schedule. The only things we needed to adhere to were the shuttles both ways. And we're an hour and a half from the shuttle London side, and we purposefully did a long day on the Friday, so that we could do a shorter day on the shuttle day, so that we had more flexibility. So like, if Bonnie started kicking off, we could just stop at the next services for as long as she needed, and then put her back in. And that, so like, that flexibility was the godsend. Whereas if like you're getting in a taxi to go to an airplane, to go to an airport, to get a plane for a certain amount of time that you need to arrive, a specific amount of hours before departure, and you're on a tight schedule, and then from then you get a train or a bus, and all of those things that are kind of more immovable. When shit goes wrong, it's like, well, we don't have a huge amount of options here. So yeah, I didn't find it as bad, but I think we had the luxury of more flexibility. But also, Bonnie's so young. Like, we were talking about how it would play next year when she's like more toddlery, trying to have her in the car for like 2.5 hour stints.
Yeah, I mean, it depends.
On the same day, basically.
Some of them are good at it. Like, some of them are just okay, I think, you know? Like, and it depends what the roads are like. And at least if you're driving, you're kind of like, we need to stop, like, right now.
Yeah.
Or we need to find a way to get on a bigger, straighter road. Like you can actually do stuff like that. Whereas, like, when you're getting, like, essentially an airport transfer and you're just weaving through the mountains, then you're just like,
roasting hot bus as well.
Probably. Yeah, you're like, I'm stuck in this car for the next hour, whatever happens.
Yeah, there's the only time that it went bad was going around Paris. So you take basically the kind of orbital route around Paris to get to where we were staying on the way back. And I don't know if you've ever driven on the orbital route or been on the orbital route around Paris, but basically it's just this tunnel that goes for like dozens of kilometers, and there's no real turnoffs. There's nowhere you can stop. Like, once you enter it, you're on it until your exit is. And our exit was like 35 kilometers away. And Bonnie just started like screaming to the point where she like made herself sick. Was just like, so it was just like 35 minutes, maybe actually probably up to an hour, because like there was a bit before that and a little bit after where we like just couldn't. I think we didn't actually even end up stopping in the end, because by the time we got out of the orbital like tunnel thing, we were like 10 minutes, 15 minutes from our destination. So we were like, let's just, there's no point stopping this stage. Let's just stop when we get there.
Agreed.
It was like an hour of proper screaming, and you just couldn't do anything about it because you're like, there's nowhere to stop. We're literally in a seemingly never-ending tunnel. That was the worst part of the journey, but other than that, when we had the flexibility, it was good. It was fine. Very manageable.
yeah, it was great, except for all the bits that were, you know,
except for the bits that weren't
extremely stressful. It's like, that's a very good description of parenting. I wouldn't be surprised if some stuff from this comes up later. But should we get into the show? Because we've actually got quite a lot to talk about. And to start off today, like on the public side, we've got a question from Joshua Davis who says, given the young player market has exploded in recent years, is there an argument for veteran players offering better value for money? If so, which veterans could be big needle movers for clubs in the Premier League? As a Spurs fan, I think a Thiago Silva at Chelsea-like player is exactly what we need. Okay. Very simple answers here to start with. Yes, I think the, you know, when someone like Moises Caicedo, like you only need to look at what Liverpool did 2 years ago to know that this is true, I think. Like Liverpool, very smart in the market. And a couple of years ago, they were like, okay, we can't pay an exorbitant fee for a DM. So we are going to go and get Wataru Endo for like basically nothing.
Yeah.
Like that's our plan. And I think that's a perfectly sensible move. And I think that if you can't get the ideal guy right now, then often getting an older guy who can tide you over for a bit is kind of smart. However, when you talk about Thiago Silva at Chelsea, I do think that is a bit of a special case. Like generally speaking, like he's a centre back. He was coming into a team which was able to play to his strengths. He also held on to his athleticism like quite late on, I think. You know, he'd lost a lot of it, but he was still pretty good. He was like shockingly good. But he was used in a back three, which is a very forgiving way to be used as a centre back. This is very different from picking up an old fullback and hoping you can get traction out of them. If you pick up someone like an old fullback or an old winger, you're probably going to have to rotate them to get value out of them. If you pick up an old kind of passing midfielder like Jorginho style or an old centre back who you can protect quite a lot because they've got a reserved fullback or they've got two centre backs around them, then it's easier to do something here. But broadly speaking, yes, temper your expectations is what
sure,
I'd say.
Yeah.
What do you think? What was your initial response to this question? Because I was quite interested looking at this and I've got quite a few players and I do understand it because like, when I came into FD and we started talking about players, like this was 2015.
Yeah.
And back then, even back then, which feels quite recent, it did feel like the conversation was all kind of, you want someone with experience, you know, you want somebody who knows the league, like all this stuff was how people talked. And when you talked about signing a 22, 23-year-old for big money, you would get the Paul Merson types saying, you know, what's he done? What's he done? What trophies has he won? And you're like, that's not the point. The point is that he's good now and he's 22 and he's going to get better and that over the life of the contract, he will retain or gain value. Whereas obviously you sign a 28-year-old on a 5-year deal and by the end of their contract, they are worse than they started and they've lost value. Like, so that was the argument is even if those two players were exactly the same over the course of their deal, it's about value retention, right? But that even 10 years ago was still a minority position. And it's only really in the last 10 years that we've seen clubs make this shift and also the perception in the popular mind, you know, change.
Yeah.
That young players are the way to go, that you always want to target young players. And even that, and now actually we have really nuanced conversations about it. So, you know, you will see people who are not that statistically minded saying stuff like, well, this club, you know, they want to win in like 2-3 years. So they should really be targeting guys who are like 22 to 24. Whereas this club, they're maybe 5 years away. So they might want to target guys who are sort of 18 to 22, for example. Like people can make that distinction between targeting young players and targeting very young players. So actually, you know, just to go back to like the state of football stats, football analytics, it does feel like one of the things that has really taken hold in football and that people now broadly understand is the concept of age curves. You still get people who say, oh, you know, Fernandinho, he signed at 28 and he was great for years. But most people understand that that's an outlier. And generally speaking, now people understand that the important thing to do is to be looking for players who are going to remain as good as they are over the course of their deal or get better.
Yes, I think the conversations around football and like kind of signing young players or that shift to signing young players, it's over what the past decade, it's gotten younger and younger and younger. It used to be, like you said, 28-year-olds, 26-year-olds who have kind of enough catalogue of experience in a top league is the kind of guy you go for at their peak. Then it's shifted to like 24, 23. Now we're looking at like 100 million pound 21-year-olds. I think there is still a huge amount of value in the veteran market. And we do shit on a lot of 28-year-olds and over on this podcast. We do. And we get criticized for calling like 28-year-olds post-peak. While that is statistically correct, or data would indicate that that's statistically accurate, there is still a lot of value in a player that's older. But like you say, it's like cost and worth value. Like they're all like the context around it basically defines whether it's a good purchase or a bad purchase. If you are a newly promoted club whose main aim, sole aim, is just to stay in the league, but you've got basically a championship level squad and not much money, maybe bringing in a couple of like older guys just to be like, this is the tone, this is what these guys have been, spent their entire career in the Premier League. Ross Barkley to Luton is an example. Sure. Kyle Walker went to Burnley literally, I think, today or yesterday. While I don't like love that, having those people in the dressing room can help. They are very experienced, and if it is enough to kind of set enough of a tone to get you to 16th, fair enough. And also, you don't have a huge amount of cash. You don't have a huge amount of wage budget, like I'm assuming. So these are, you know, they help fiscally in that sense. If you are a big team who are looking at like a 50, 60 game season, trying to go deep, but you're thinking, I'm pretty weak in this area or this area, you could go out and get a 22-year-old to kind of be that backup, but they'll be more expensive. They'll be unproven. You could go get a 29, 30-year-old who's done it, been there and done that, and be like, you are going to be a rotation option because we are going to essentially compete for a domestic title and try and go deep in a continental tournament. Mm-hmm. There's going to be lots of games, but we have a guy in front of you who's 24 and like one of our star players, but you're a European top five league proven player. We know what your output is. We know exactly what you are. We think you fit with the system. You're not going to cost a huge amount of money because your value diminishes year on year exponentially at this point. Mm-hmm. Your output is diminishing. You're not at peak anymore. You are post-peak, but we're fine with that because we just need more robust, reliable players in this position. Super lucrative and could be the difference between a top team, a team like Arsenal, who are, you know, getting the semi-finals or quarter-finals of the Champions League, finishing second. It could be the difference of them being able to ride out an injury crisis or like an injury period of one of their big players without a significantly damaging effect on their season, enough to get them over the line in some competition. So I think there's huge value there. Whereas like a team that is, say, rebuilding like Manchester United, miles off the top, but largely safe where they are, also slightly getting older and older. Well, they've made a big, big push to get younger. Like Liverpool have slowly gotten older and older. So I guess if there's a team in like a rebuild, a middling team who's trying to get back to what they were, there isn't as much value there because you should have veterans enough to steady that ship, and you want to be significantly investing in youth to get your average squad age down so that you, when 5 years' time, they will be hitting their peak when you should also, as a club, be back competing with something. If you invest loads of money, or even if they are cheap, even if you invest that money and time and you build a system that incorporates these players, they will age out before you're good. So they're minimal gains in the short term for like not much in the long term. So while there is a huge amount of value to be had in this veteran market, it is very, very situational. But generally speaking, the negative way, at least financially, the negative way that age has been viewed since we've had this massive shift to buy young, don't buy 24-year-old players, buy 21-year-old players, buy 18-year-old players.
Mm-hmm.
It has meant that it actually has created a you know, bigger than ever imbalance between performance output and market value for players over the age of 28. So 538 did a study across Europe's top five leagues, and it showed that a player's output and on-pitch influence declines about 1.5% to 2% per year after they turn 27. Other studies have shown that players' market value drops 15% to 20% per year after they turn 28. So we're looking at like a 10 times imbalance there of a player's diminishing, say, 2% a year from 28 years old on, but their market value is dropping 15%. So hypothetically speaking, we could have a 30-year-old player who will be operating at around 90% of the player they were at 27, but their value will have dropped by 40%. So that imbalance creates some really lucrative and potentially beneficial opportunities if you can get it right. Like the data generally shows that players hit their like output ceiling at 23 to 26. Somewhere in that window is a player's general. It depends on position, but general, a player's like height of their ceiling arrives sometime around 23 to 26. We know this already. But what you might not know is that that output does drop off, but it doesn't drop off substantially. It is maintained close enough until they're about 32. So there's a huge gap there between 26 and 32 where a player's market value is essentially going off a cliff, but their output, while declining, is still staying above respectable. There are obvious like instances that it's kind of confirmation bias when you remember the guys who do drop off a cliff. Like one season they're good and then the next season they're like, holy shit, who is this guy? That does happen, but on average, players tend to decline slowly, but their market value drops significantly sharper and more quickly. And I think that is where if you can get it right and you have a reason to go out and buy an older player and you can put them to good use in a system and a situation that, you know, makes sense, I think this is a really, really good option, especially if you're strapped for cash, especially if you're like struggling to kind of stay within PSR. But this isn't me saying every club should go out and buy a 30-year-old who was class when they were 26, but they're now half the price they were. Like it just doesn't work like that. It's very situational. But mm-hmm. It's a really interesting question because like all of our, basically we have done what? This is episode 64. So we've done like over 120 episodes since we started, ish, probably somewhere around there. And every time we've spoken about like signings, every time we've spoken about players, it has always seemed very youth focused. The players we dive into are like kind of unknown players who are 22, 23. Like this player who's playing in Eredivisie is 23 years old, but like he could be the next big thing for your club. It's very rarely been focused on players who are like 30. What could they do next?
But it's not glamorous. And I also think that like, I understand what you're saying before as well about the player value dropping, but the player value is obviously not quite the same as like what the player would cost. So like, what a player's value is rated out on Transfermarkt. Oh, wow. Like his value has dropped by like 15 mil, even though his output has only dropped by 4%. Okay. Yeah. But in reality, it would still cost you an arm and a leg to actually buy that player. Like there are plenty of players who are 31, 32, that if you try to buy them from another Premier League club, that Premier League club would say, we're going to charge you 20, 30 mil for this guy.
Yeah, but in that case, you leave it. But I know, but what I'm
saying is that like I think these studies are right in that they are identifying something broadly going on, which is that like these players are undervalued.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're undervalued by as much as the study would suggest, because I think the buying price,
not 10 times.
The buying price is almost always significantly higher than the market value. If you're buying someone out of their contract, especially because, you know, loads of these clubs, they rely on these guys. They say, okay, well, yeah, like he's 31, 32, but like he still does a job for us, and we've now got to go out and sign somebody else who's going to cost us three times as much as we get. You know, it's kind of like this Brentford thing with Norgaard.
Wait, I was just
right?
about to like, say that they, 12 mil.
I know, but Arsenal have gone and got Norgaard, and I think they were just kind of like, we have to do this now, but they've been trying to put it off for ages. And I think if you tried to do it last summer, they'd have been like, they'd have quoted you an insane price. Like, I think they've been weirdly reasonable about that, because they could have said, no, it's actually been incredibly hard for us to replace him, and charged quite a bit more, which we have seen in the past. You know, a lot of Premier League clubs have charged a fortune for their old guys. If you wanted to go and get, I don't know, imagine if you wanted to go and buy Alisson from Liverpool. Technically, could be available. They've got Mamardashvili coming in this summer. Like, could be an available guy. How much do you think they charge for him? I think they would charge you a lot of money, even though his market value might have dropped, significantly.
The moves that we're talking about are sensible. You said, you've mentioned Wataru Endo. We've just mentioned Norgaard. These are guys who, you say, buying these players is generally unglamorous. It's not a glamorous thing to buy a 31-year-old, or generally speaking. So why would you then go for like one of the most glamorous goalkeepers in the last 10 years? you could go for somebody with, because also like in
because
my,
you're like because he's approaching the end of his contract, and because Liverpool have bought a young goalkeeper who they presumably want to blood in the Premier League. Like Liverpool are preparing for him to leave. You'd say, okay, well, you know, if a club just goes and buys a replacement for one of their players, it doesn't matter if that guy's been a star. But you'd say, given his age and the fact you've just gone and signed a replacement, we expect this guy to be available for a cheap fee. And that, but I think that these big teams do just say, no.
Sure, my argument is that you would then just leave it. There will be other players who will be around. So I'm looking at this as kind of like,
yeah,
keepers slightly different. Keepers and centre backs are slightly different because, you know, a 30-year-old, you would expect a keeper and a centre back to be able to be like, they could be your starter, they could be good enough. I think most other positions at that age, you're expecting them to be, except maybe like a quarterbacky centre mid or 10. But generally, these players I'm viewing as like backups or rotation options, building out, filling out a squad exactly like they said, exactly like you said, Norgaard, exactly like Liverpool signed Endo. So I don't think it needs to be glamorous. And if you go for a glamorous option at a big club and they say, well, it's going to be 40 mil, and you're like, well, good luck with that.
Yeah, all I'm saying is that I think that quite often the older players who are available for bargain fees tend to come from clubs who generally charge reasonable fees for everyone. Like, don't get me wrong, they're going to charge more for a young player. You know, we'll come onto some of these in a bit. And I think that, like, reasonable clubs are reasonable and unreasonable clubs are unreasonable. And it might be that we see a change, that as we see more players wind down their contracts, or we see clubs that are hamstrung with having signed, you know, stars to long deals or whatever it might be, or, you know, the Saudi money dries up, all this kind of stuff, then we might see clubs being much more willing to say, well, you know, Edison is getting on a bit, so we will actually sell you Edison for a reasonable fee.
Yeah.
You know, like right now, we still have conversations where we say, this guy's 29, he's got a year left on his deal, they should be willing to sell him for a reasonable price. And they'll just say, absolutely not, you know. And anyway, it's generally speaking, I think we agree with the premise. So we've got a couple of players who I think are worth talking about. One, I mean, look, obviously, you know, we've seen Luka Modric leave Real Madrid this summer, and Thomas Müller available as well. Has Thomas Müller signed somewhere? Did he sign somewhere? I can't remember if he did. Like, there were talks about him signing for someone weird, like Stuttgart or something. But, like, he's 35. Modric is 39?
Yeah, Modric is 39. Wait, is he 40? No, he's not 40. But he's old.
Yeah. So those are guys who I think can very clearly still contribute at quite a high level. Like, Thomas Müller is an extremely energetic, very fit, very flexible attacker who, when he came into the Bayern team last season after not being first choice, was actually extremely good. And I think that given the injury to Musiala now, Bayern might be thinking, oh, wouldn't be the worst thing to have Thomas Müller here, because otherwise, what are we going to do now? Like genuinely, that's really difficult, because
you just can't mitigate for your star wonder kid to break their leg in preseason.
Yeah, and maybe they just think, well, you can't, but you also
don't want to leave yourself vulnerable. Yeah.
But it also sucks if it happens in the summer that you got rid of his aging backup. It would have been nice if at least anybody they got in, like say they say, oh, Elise can play attacking mid, they're looking for a winger anyway, because we know they are looking for a winger. Okay, we go and get a winger, that winger can take some minutes on both flanks, and then Elise plays attacking mid and we're kind of okay. It would still be nice if you had Müller there and said, Müller can give us 10 to 15 good games in the Bundesliga, maybe 10 good games in the Bundesliga. Like, that's actually like a third of a season. Like, that's a really useful rotation piece. Losing him and getting this Musiala injury at the same time, pretty bad. I'm not sure I'd recommend that a club sign him on a big deal or an expensive deal. But if, for example, you were on the edge of a title, you know, if you were like an Italian side and you expected to be like stuck in a pretty sticky title race, and maybe you needed someone who could cover attacking mid and maybe in a pinch cover striker, you know, with goal scoring wingers, like, would Thomas Müller be a bad signing? I don't think so, but I'm not really going to talk about them. Two guys quickly to mention: Raf Guerrero, who has a year left on his deal. Aymeric Laporte, his contract is up in Saudi next summer. He's 31. I think he'll be 32 by the time that contract is up. He's a really good passer and always has been, and I think would still be a really good passer. I would not sign him expecting him to be a starter, But it depends on the kind of team you are. So if you're a conservative team and you need a good ball progressor, like, for example, Aston Villa, like a team like Aston Villa, he'd be a really interesting pickup. And the thing is about this as well, you can mitigate risk by saying, if your contract is up, we will offer you a like, we want you to come and try out physically just to help us, like, get some data on where you are. And that's reasonable. Like, some players might say no, but some players will be up for it, because if they could come back and play in the Premier League and earn decent money at 31, 32, they'll probably be interested. Italy would also make sense for him. So there are a couple of guys like that who I'd be interested in. But my big candidate here is Yohan Visser from Brentford. So to some degree, this depends on if Mbeumo goes for big money, and it looks like that'll happen. The money has gone from, like... The money is crazy.
60 plus mil, all, like, if you include all of the add-ons that are potentially being, like, bandied in with it, it's just like, it's just, I kind of, oh my God.
I kind of thought United would open at 40, but including apparently achievable...
They opened at 45 plus 10 or something.
Yeah, but apparently the 10 are like, you know, it's not like he has to win the Ballon d'Or. It's like he plays like 100 games with the club or something.
Yeah.
Like, if, so you're basically opening at like 55. Let's say 50 then. Let's say it's probably like, let's say 5 million in easy add-ons and 5 million in hard. You're opening at 50. Then it went to 55. Now it's looking like they want 65 guaranteed.
Yeah.
Which is fucking insane. Like, you're starting to get to the, you're starting to get to like, why aren't we just buying Rodrigo money?
Yeah.
But anyway, if Mbeumo goes for big money, Brentford might go out and do some interesting shit. They also might try and lock Visser down, because it's it's quite easy to re-up a player like this. But he's 28 now. He's 29 this September. He has 1 year left on his deal. If I were interested in like a versatile forward right now, do I think Mbeumo's more talented? Like, yeah, probably. But Visser is a really good, smart player. And I think the season he's had was... was arguably better than Mbeumo's. He had 19 goals in the league and 4 assists. I didn't realise he had that many, but that's crazy. He was at 0.65 expected goals and assists per 90. And the season before, he was at 0.5. So he's been above Mbeumo both those seasons.
Yeah.
And I also am inclined to think that he'll probably have quite a late peak, because I was looking at the number of career appearances he's got, and he kind of bounced around France quite a lot when he was young. And he's only got 266 club appearances to his name and another 33 for the DRC. So he's on 299 career appearances at nearly 29.
Is that it?
That's so few, right? Like, yeah. That's like 100 fewer than someone like Zinchenko, you know, who's in the same neck of the woods. Maybe not Zinchenko, somebody else. Zinchenko's, I think, at about 350. So he also doesn't have that many games, actually, weirdly.
Yeah, because, I mean, like, he didn't get a huge amount of time at City.
Yeah, but I looked at a bunch of people around his age in the Premier League, and he had the fewest of anyone that I could see at this point. James Maddison is about the same age, has 100 more career appearances than him.
And has been injured for half of his fucking career.
Yeah, so that's like 2.5 extra seasons you're looking at there, or at least 2 extra seasons on a player. So I think that you might get more traction out of Visser. Visser, he's pretty positionally versatile. I wouldn't play him as an out-and-out winger, but you could play him behind a striker. You can play him as the centre forward. I think you could start him wide in a system where you had an attacking fullback and he was actually expected to come inside.
Yeah.
He is basically a centre forward. Like, if you look at his touches and he's at like 14 passes per game in the Premier League. So that's a striker. But in the past, more dribbles attempted, more expected assists, more defensive work. So I think he can drop deep, do a little bit more. When he was a kid at Lorient, when I say kid, like 23, so this is some time ago, he was actually really a wide guy. Like, he looked like a wide guy in the stats, like pretty decent one. So I don't know how good a match he is for a really big team. Like, he kind of wants to play in a 2 up top, or he wants to play in a transitional side. Like, I think he can do a bit of everything pretty well, but he's not someone who's gonna, like, be an outstanding center forward for you, or be an outstanding attacking mid or winger. Like, what he is a little bit better at the winger stuff than you might expect for a center forward. Yeah. Better at the center forward stuff than you might expect for a guy who's not that big.
But he's a lead at neither, I guess.
Yeah, but like, Jonathan David looks like he's going to go to Juventus, provided they can iron out this insane agent's fee. Like, okay, he's younger, but Visser, I think, has proved himself at a higher level, broadly. Yeah.
Jonathan David's a weird one. It's always been a weird one.
And I think there are clubs around who can get value out of people like this. You know, we always use them, but Atletico Madrid are quite willing to play with a two up top. Like, if I was Atletico Madrid and somebody said to me, hey, what if your Alvarez backup was Joan Visser? I'd think that's pretty good. Mm. Like, he's not as good at everything as Alvarez is, but he's not the worst backup to him. I think Visser would have made some sense for United if the price was cheap. I don't know what the price would have been. But Cunha and Diallo behind Visser, I think, is better than Cunha and Mbeumo behind whatever bullshit they're playing up front next season. Yeah.
Rashford, like, who knows?
I think Diallo is currently at least as good as Mbeumo. That is my feeling. And Visser in front of them, I think, would be quite exciting because Cunha has some centre-forward stuff about him too. And then you've got a really fluid front three that's quite hard to deal with. Whereas Cunha and Mbeumo, yeah, behind Xerxes. Like, woo. What? I mean, is that so exciting? Like, so I
generally just don't like Cunha and Mbeumo as a dual 10 full stop.
Well, especially when you've got Diallo on the books. But yeah, it's not really a problem. Like, I think Cunha and Mbeumo behind a striker will be a big improvement for United. Like, I actually, like, this is the thing. I would not make those moves. Those moves are hideously overpriced. I think both those players are good, but not great. And United are paying great prices for them. I think the centre forward is almost a bigger issue and actually is probably quite solvable for a team like United right now, because
United have half a dozen players who can play in the positions they've signed two players for.
Yeah, and also United are not like Chelsea or Arsenal, right? Which are, those teams are expecting to be
good,
camped out in, yes, and they're but also they're, stylistically they're expecting to be camped out in an opposition third where their striker needs to be kind of, if not their striker, then somebody needs to be an amazing mover.
Yeah.
Their striker
need
to
space when against a low block against.
Yeah, their striker needs no to space. Occupy centre backs at least so that the winger can be the one who makes the movement. Or the striker needs to be a great mover. For United, I kind of feel like United should just be getting an athletic guy who gets tons and tons of shots.
Yeah.
Like, that is what United. That's what United would really want. Like, if they could get Ekitike, that would be like the dream. But like, failing that, Gyökeres would have made more sense for United than he does for Arsenal. Darwin Núñez would be perfect for United, like perfect for them. He would be fantastic for United, like given their needs. So whatever. Anyway, to go back to Visser, I think he's pretty quick. He's pretty strong. He's clearly smart. I think that there's a little bit of ugly duckling with Visser. You know, like I think people watch Mbeumo. I think people watch Mbeumo and he scores like the occasional beautiful volley, and they think like this is an aesthetically pleasing player. And I do think for some people that adds like 20, 30 mil to what you think they're worth.
Yeah.
Visser, when you look at his goals, a lot of them are like he bundles it in 6 yards out because he gets his big bald head to it before somebody else does. And I think, but that's a good, that's a good player. Makes him aerodynamic.
Yeah, they all look the same in score sheet. He just gets shit done.
And look at it, and this is the thing, like Villarreal got a lot out of Ayoze Perez last season. Villarreal are actually a really good team for this kind of stuff. It's always worth looking at what they're doing. They signed Alberto Molero this summer. They always do fun, cool stuff. Villarreal, they're a really smart club. Visser could do something for a team like that, certainly, but he could also do it for a good Bundesliga team. Mm. I think
he cost a lot more than Ayoze Perez did, though.
With
like
a year
left. Oh, with a year left. But he's also younger. He's 20. Like, he's not that old.
He's 29 in two, like, 3rd of September, I think it is. So, like, he is 29 exceptionally soon. And it depends whether he's open to signing a new contract. Like, if he says to Brentford, if somebody goes and like, shows serious interest in him, and he says to Brentford, I'm not signing that new contract. Like, no way. Mm. Brentford will sell him because Brentford are not stupid. And if your team, like, Bayer Leverkusen or something, I kind of think Joan Visser would absolutely slap for you. I think he'd be really good. So anyway, that's my chief one. The only other name I have is a guy called Valentin Rongier, who is at Marseille. His contract's also up next season. He's 30 and he's just a DM with just like, he's just decent DM. Like, good defensive numbers, loads of ball recoveries. Like, he's historically been at like 8 per 90. Now he's down to 5. So maybe there's a physical drop off. I think his role's slightly changed. Fouls have gone up too. So maybe you're like, ooh, I don't know. Is he as quick as he used to be? But again, we've seen teams, especially in Italy, take older midfielders and get a lot of mileage out of them. Like, obviously Inter Milan famously have done this, but other teams do it as well. Roma have done it too. You can go and get this guy who gives you 6 final third entries a game, but still has 90% pass accuracy, has nearly 5 tackles and interceptions. Like, What's he going to cost you from Marseille with a year left on his deal? Not that much. If Brentford went and got him for a small fee, because they've just signed Milambo, who it looks like they might move him back and make him kind of like the central midfield guy. He's played a bit more of an advanced role, but basically he's good at the deeper midfield stuff. If they got him and then they got someone like Rongier to help replace Norgaard, I think that would be great. If they're like, okay, you'll give us 1 to 2 years while this guy adapts, and we've got a bit of rotation, we've got a bit of safety there, because if I were Brentford, I'd be maybe a little bit scared this season, having lost your manager, potentially losing some key players. So those are my ones. I think it's quite hard to find these guys, because to some degree, I think market opportunities are like, you find out about them if you work in the market. like Arsenal knowing that Norgaard might be available for 10 mil, I don't think there's any way that we could have really known that.
I was listening to a thing that was like, it was Orange, I think Ornstein was in a podcast somewhere or whatever. But basically, like, Ornstein plugged in as much as any outsider can be at Arsenal, really. Had no idea, he didn't see Norgaard coming. So it's like, that was really kind of just on the inside, being like, oh shit, this is potentially something we could do. Should we do it? Because it makes sense. Yes. And then it's done. That kind of came out of nowhere. So yeah, I think it is difficult to kind of, from our perspective, from our side, to categorically pick out these players. I did notice, though, that when you were mentioning players in Serie A who are a bit older, midfielders too, that have come there and done very, very, very well, you failed to mention the current Serie A player of the season, Scott McTominay.
Yeah, I still think that's going to be a kind of disastrous deal for Napoli.
It doesn't matter
because it's won the Scudetto. Yeah. And I think that Napoli are fine with having like 5 years in the wilderness, having won the Scudetto twice recently.
But
it's not a move that I still think like...
It's a move that created a moment in the sun, and that's all you need from it.
But that's the thing, isn't it? Like, we don't really assess the move that way. And I still kind of think that was exceptionally fortunate. Right. If Inter had their shit together, Inter came fucking close to stealing that title. And to be honest, the fact that they didn't is a bit embarrassing. But, you know, like, look, I'm glad. Like, I'm very fond of Napoli, so it's great. But like, when a transfer happens, you can only assess it as a transfer. And I think as a transfer,
the money was hefty.
It was way too much money. And I think that, you know,
and justify the means, baby.
And especially when you don't have Conte. Like, can you imagine another manager looking at Scott McTominay saying, like, what the fuck is this? Like,
you're eating cardboard in the corner. Yeah.
You're a midfielder, but you only get shots.
Yeah.
Do you do anything else? It's like, no.
No. You just crash the box and just dive at balls. So yeah, that's it.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, that's basically my thing. It's like, so could I play you as a striker? No.
No.
I can't do that. Yeah. No. I have to start in midfield. Okay.
Yeah, I need to get up to speed. Yeah.
All right, pal. That's such a like Italian success story where you're like, there's nowhere else this could have worked and there's no other manager it could have worked for. Anyway.
I do.
I've gone on really long. Who are your players? Because we got to get to the burn, but we need some motor.
I mean, I can drop a couple here because
I'd like to hear yours.
When you sent me the question, you sent me a screenshot, so I missed the bottom half of the question. I think the bottom half of the question was like about mentioned Spurs and kind of mentioned bigger clubs, but I went for like slightly more for the everyman, for the every club players that you're like are out of contract but still have value, that players that a newly promoted team could pick up or like a lower mid-table Premier League team could pick up and like instantly add value or add depth. Before that, there are two players that I think keeping tabs on for next season are interesting because Bernardo Silva is one of them. He's currently 31. His extension runs out in 2026. If you sign on for one more year and the club sign you on for one more year, like basically that's saying we're both not ready to part ways yet, but we're going to part ways in a year. I don't feel that he's going to get renewed at that point. So I think he'll walk on free at the end of this season coming up. If you can get that contract right, if you can pay him like a palatable amount of wages, give him a role that fits him, hey, that's a really tasty player to have on your books at 30. He'll be 32 at that point. Even if you get a couple of seasons out of him, I think that's a really, basically for any decent club, that's like semi-decent club, that's somebody that you should be like, let's give his agent a phone call and see what is it. Like, what's the lay of the land? The other player, Bruno Fernandes. So, He is the same age as Bernardo Silva. I think he's a month older. But Bruno Fernandes was on the you know, not the chopping block, but he was up for sale this summer. For me, this is the last summer that you could realistically get proper money for him. And even still, that proper money was Saudi money, which kind of comes with an asterisk. So he's contracted 2027, but I don't think that matters, because if the Amorim project works, if Amorim stays, even if the Amorim project doesn't work, but the club back him, United will be motivated to move him on, because he just naturally doesn't fit and he's getting older. He will be like at the end of this season, coming by the start of next season, or at the very early stages of next season, as in like the one after the one about to start, he'll be 32. And he's undoubtedly has had multiple world-class seasons. He doesn't rely a huge amount of physicality. He's kind of quarterbacky, which historically has aged quite well.
Yeah.
Especially if you're allowed to shirk a ton of defensive responsibility, which he does already. So you can see him being a 32, 33, 34-year-old player that you just drop in the middle of a kind of diamond midfield that has two players behind him to mop up all the stuff he doesn't do.
Yeah.
Or like a triangle three, whatever. And him be super, super effective. You can drop him in, wind him up and be like, go create. And he'll
He could do like, you know, like, he's not this kind of passer. But like, I was going to say late career Toni Kroos. He's not really that. Like, I know he's not really that. But like, he could do a bit of that. The creative stuff that Toni Kroos did. What he can actually do is 2013-14 Steven Gerrard, right? Where you've got a guy who can play...
2013-14 Steven Gerrard. That wasn't on my bingo card for this evening.
But do you not think like that's exactly what we're talking about? Like Steven Gerrard back then was kind of controlling tempo from deep, but really he was playing insane passes for quite an exciting attacking front line, and he just had a bunch of protection around him. Like you put workhorses in front of him, and then all you did was have this guy who had no legs left but still had the most incredible ping on him.
I feel Bruno Fernandes would be on the other side of that midfield though. Significantly higher up.
I don't think he needs to be. Like, I think if you're gonna play him in this role, you got to play him a bit deeper. Like, unfortunately, United have devoted a great deal of funds this summer to trying to strengthen their midfield. Like, United have obviously gone out this summer and added a lot of athleticism to their midfield, which, as we know, they needed to do. United, of course, have gone and addressed this massive, glaring weakness in their squad that everyone can see.
Yeah.
So that's good.
Fantastic, isn't it?
But
Mbeumo's 65 mil, it's fine.
To be honest, United need to add some athletic midfielders either way. They need to do it either way. They might as well do it. And if it means they can get value out of Fernandes in his old age, like, look at it. Like, right now, Kevin De Bruyne has obviously gone to Napoli.
Yeah.
He's very close to Fernandes in age, right?
Yeah, he's like 3 years older, I think.
Is he really? He's 33. He's 33, I thought. And,
I thought he was 34.
Oh, maybe he is. Okay, yeah, he's 34. Okay, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, and Bruno, this thing is going into next season, he'll be 32. Okay,
yeah,
so,
yeah, yeah. So
he's
so
fucking
Bruno's,
30. Okay,
Bruno's
that's the 30, difference.
Bruno's about to turn 31.
Okay,
so
okay.
Coming into this, because he's not going to leave this season. So next season, he might be attainable and he would go into that season, or he would start that season as a 31-year-old and almost immediately turn 32.
But also, my point kind of still stands in that, like, I have more faith in Bruno aging than De Bruyne, in a way. Partially because he's been much more physically durable than De Bruyne.
De Bruyne's injuries in his later years so far have been concerning.
But also, I think that De Bruyne at his best was insanely dynamic.
Yeah,
like, he was an amazing runner through midfield. He's still a great passer, but... it's very difficult that, like, a big part of his game has been lost. And I do think that when a big part of your game has been lost, you can adapt, but it's not going to be as natural to you. Whereas, like, Bruno Fernandes, he was always, like, buzzing around, but he's never been exceptionally fast or strong. And I think as a result, like, Bruno shouldn't lose too much.
Like,
I don't know. Maybe that's not true. Like, when you're fast, when you're younger... as you get older, you become less fast, but you're still faster than a guy who was always slow, you know?
Sure.
So this kind of stuff, it's a bit hard to say. It depends how the mental abilities catch up with someone physically. But I look at somebody like Bruno Fernandes, and I think your skill set should not radically change.
No.
Over the next couple of years. And you've never been a guy who's just crocked all the time. So, like, if you go to Italy...
Oh my God,
next
destroy
year,
Italy.
If he went to Italy and played for a smart, like went to like Atalanta or something.
Yeah.
Or Roma, Lorenzo Pellegrini will be out of contract next year. And Lorenzo Pellegrini like had a really weird career fall off like 2 years ago. If you just plugged Bruno Fernandes into a side with a couple of mobile attackers and some midfielders that can really run, I would be excited. I think that's really fun.
And like we're from the moving on from a United perspective, if he doesn't fit that system, so they know that. They were open to a £100 million move this summer. They are open to shifting him on, even if that is just shifting on his wages as well. United being good, like genuinely good, does not include Bruno Fernandes. And it kind of doesn't include Bruno Fernandes in the current iteration, never mind the good iteration. So they, if Amorim stays, that's a very, very, very big if, United will be very open to shifting him on in the last year of his contract as a 31-year-old turning 32. I think if you can get that contract right, United might hold out for a bigger fee than is worth, but if you can get that contract right, if you can get that fee right, Bruno Fernandes is like twilight years outside of Old Trafford, I think could be really lucrative. But those are like the bigger names that I kind of went for, as in keep a tab on them, see how they perform this season, reassess coming into next summer. But I approach the section more from like how I approach any Football Manager game when I do like a lower table, like a top championship team or lower Premier League team, is that I go and sign wonder kids on loan, like 18-year-old wonder kids on loan, and I do a search for out of contract in a year but has X amount of international caps. So sure. Like your former international veterans. And I kind of went for that angle, being like, who could a mid-table, lower mid-table Premier League or European top five league team get in for like very, very cheap, virtually nothing, especially if they're out of contract, and them do a good job, right? The first one I have, I just like the player. I don't think this is actually feasible. Or I think you do a lot of, it would take a huge amount of convincing because he is a Sassuolo boy for life.
Oh, okay.
But I do love Domenico Berardi.
Man, and he was meant to go. He was meant to
if he
leave
wasn't injured.
when he was young, and then he had a really bad injury at just the wrong time.
And then the same thing happened. So the same thing happened again when Sassuolo got relegated last season.
Okay.
Yeah, so when he's like 28, 29, Sassuolo got relegated. They came straight back up. They got promoted last year again. But he had like a long-term injury at the point they got relegated. He's their captain. He's been there since like the youth academy. He was sold to Juventus, but never actually played for them, really. He came back on loan and then was sold back again a season or two after that. But like, I kind of feel that if he didn't have a long-term injury at the point that Sassuolo were relegated, that will be the point that you pick him up. That will be the point that you move.
Sure.
But I'm not saying it will be a player that I would ring up and be like, do you fancy a swing at the Premier League before you retire? Because he's 30 year old. He's a left-footed right winger, which we've always speak about being an incredibly valuable build of player. He's about to turn 31. He's got like really strong output across his career. He's averaging 0.5 non-expected goal involvements per 90 across his entire career. 3.5 shots a game, over two key passes, 0.3 expected assists per 90. He obviously played in Serie B last year, had a decent season, 6 goals, 13 assists. So Sassuolo came straight back up. His like peak years, 24 to 26, he was averaging 15 goals and 10 assists in Serie A. And while he has declined since that, his decline has been actually really, really, really slow. So he's averaged 0.85 goal involvements per 90 across the 6 seasons since he turned 24.
Okay.
Which is strong. So he had some incredible seasons now, but he's averaging 0.8 goal involvements per 90. That includes penalties.
Man, he's always been good, man. And the thing is, like, when he was young, he really popped for shots, but now he really does, like...
He's still getting 3.5 shots a game.
Yeah, but now what he really has done is like with age become an incredible creative passer.
Creator, yeah.
Like there are guys like Nico Paz. Like we've talked about Nico Paz, who's obviously playing in Serie A as well. Like Berardi is actually quite a similar player, but like considerably older. And I actually really like this. If you're a smart team, like this is a guy who will get you a bunch of, who can just do a bunch of like attacking midfield shit for you.
Yeah.
If you were like Palace and you said, we need another guy who can play behind a forward who's just a different type. Like, Saar is more of a winger. This guy's more of like a kind of creative second striker. Like, he's not quite a 10. He's not quite a striker. Like, Berardi's a good player.
Like, the problem is that he's a swallow boy for life. Like, that is the kicker. If he wasn't as attached to the club, it's an easier sell. I think at this stage, the fact that he's gone down with them, like, he started in Serie B with them. I think his first season with them out of the youth team. They were in Serie B and then they got promoted. Then they spent the entire time in Serie A and then got relegated last season and got promoted straight again. I think the fact that he's been through all of that, he's their captain, he's 30, he's about to turn 31. If you look at a player who's done all that, it feels like if they were going to leave, they would have left 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I think that's the hard sell, but I think he would be so good for, like you say, like a mid-table, like a Palace, like a mid-table Premier League team just needs somebody who can do a bit of everything that you can drop into multiple scenarios. That, and it's just really efficient and you can create, can score, has been consistent across their entire career. I have a lot of time for him. Love to see him in Premier League. I just think I would phone him up and be like, what's crack? What are we talking?
Sure.
And see what happens. But yeah, so that's the kind of stretchier one. But the main one I would look at, it's another Manchester United, former Manchester United player. And I know you're going to hate this, but I think there's so much left in this player for them to be a free agent. Anybody south of...
Come on.
7th, 8th in the Premier League should be like...
Oh, Jesus.
Do you want to have a chat? Victor Lindelof.
What?
Victor, he is so underrated.
He has not been playing for a United team that fucking suck. Dreadful.
That is circumstantial. He also, but the thing is, right?
Yeah, the circumstances being he's crap. Like,
but he played. So United teams have been bad for a while. Arguably, United teams have been bad since Ferguson left. Arguably, United teams have been bad since before then. It was just that perhaps Ferguson was just hacked the system. That the squad he won his last title with was absolutely dross. But if you look at the most successful period United have had post Ferguson, which are the two seasons where they finished second and third, 2020. To 2019 to 2021, those two seasons, only time United have finished in the top three since Ferguson retired.
Mm-hmm.
Lindelof played, you know, I would say 80% of the league minutes available to him. Like, I think he played like, so there's what, say 30 games, so you're at like 76 games available, 76 90s. He played 63 90s out of that in United's most technically. League position-wise, most successful period since Ferguson retired. Lindelof was the mainstay in that too. And I'm not saying that he's an elite player. I'm not saying that he's even good enough to start for Manchester United or that he should have been starting for Manchester United. I'm saying that this guy's a free agent. He's 30 years old. He's a proven Premier League player. He's got 8 seasons in the Premier League under his belt, over 15,000 Premier League minutes, 5,000 continental minutes across Champions League and Europa League. 71 international caps, has, like I just said, played a huge role in United's most consistent league performance since Ferguson retired. This guy's walking around for free, and you have teams like Wolves, you have teams like you could just, you know, here's a contract we'll offer you. We don't need to pay anything up front because you're a free agent. We know that you are a reliable Premier League body that we can bring into our squad that will just add depth. And we're not going to say you're going to start every game, but for the fact that you're literally just a free agent without club, like David De Gea is an example of a free agent without club for ages. Went to Fiorentina and has been fantastic. Interestingly, saying that, Lindelof of Fiorentina, don't mind it, because there is a Milenkovic shape hole there. But yeah, like across his time at United, he was averaging 2 tackles and interceptions per 90, which isn't big. But he's like...
No, it's not. It's not big.
But Van Dijk's numbers aren't big. He isn't like a rush out and level
you. Yeah, they're not. Yeah, I agree. But like, I don't know, man.
He's a more cultured centre-back. He'll shout.
Look, you watch more of him than I have. But nobody's watched that much because he never fucking plays. But like, I get...
He's got 50,000 minutes in Premier League. Scott McTominay had under 10,000 Premier League minutes when he moved to Napoli.
When I watch United, I don't watch United. Like that's
you watch United when they play Arsenal. Yeah.
Well, I think that the thing is, when United have the ball and they're attacking, you can't see the centre backs. And when other teams are attacking United, their centre back positioning is so bad that you can't see the centre backs. So it's actually very hard to get a sense of what the centre backs can do and can't do because they're not there. Like, I don't know. Like, look, if it, yeah, he's free. How old did you say he was again?
He's 30.
That's older than I'd like.
for a free player with 15,000 Premier League minutes. No, because he wouldn't leave on a free at that point. So, like, for me, he's a proven Premier League player. He's comfortable in the ball. He's not an amazing passer, but he's comfortable passing in the midfield. His profile is big enough. He's winning, like, historically 60% of his duels on the ground and in the air. He doesn't engage a huge amount because he tries to shepherd players into better positions that he's more comfortable with, which is inside of a more intelligent centre-back, which will generally age better. Problem with that is it does leave you vulnerable to, like, really fast or tricky. If you give them time to get up to speed, he gets into trouble. That is a big downfall of him. He can give too much space to very dangerous players because it's kind of the way he defends. His calm presence on the ball. Like, for me, this presents a really good opportunity to get, like, a ready-to-go Premier League quality centre-back for a mid to lower Premier League team in the door for virtually nothing. Like, I think this is something that anybody who finished 10th or below should, not including United and Spurs, or who are a newly promoted team, should be like, could we make a contract for Victor Lindelof work? Also, while he is 30, I think he'd profile closer to 28 because one, centre-backs age slower, or they, especially centre-backs that aren't like full speed engagement centre-backs will age better as long as they can keep their pace up enough to for them not to get blown by, basically. He's also only averaged 21 Premier League 90s a season across his 8 seasons at United, so he's not been run into the ground. I think he profiles closer to a 28-year-old than he does a 30-year-old, minutes-wise, and just the play style he has. And like I say, he's just been and done the Premier League for ages. He might not have done it fantastically well, but he's good enough for a lower table club to add value and to add depth as a free agent.
Look, if it makes you happy, like, sure, Victor Lindelof. Like, you know, he is cheap. It's not Thiago Silva at Chelsea. Like, but
yeah, but that would have cost a lot more.
But you're right.
But also, he's not signing for Chelsea.
That didn't cost anything. He was free. But like,
yeah, but in wages. But he's not signing for Chelsea. He's signing for, like, fucking Wolves.
Yeah, Wolves do suck. And he presumably speaks Portuguese. That's helpful. I don't know. Like, basically, I think we're in agreement on this. There are loads of these guys to be found. I think Berardi is actually a real favourite. Like, that would be an exciting thing to see. I expect to see more of this going forward. And I think teams might be a bit more realistic about moving some of these guys on because teams need room in there.
Yeah.
In their squad now. With a more chock-a-block season, you can't afford to have too much dead squad space, right? Like, look at Arsenal ending their deal with Tomiyasu. Like, basically saying,
yeah,
sorry, man, but, like, you're not going to get fit again. And, like, we actually do need the squad space. We'd rather pay you to go away. Like, I think
it's just easier.
With that in mind, like, there are some teams who'll probably say, yeah, you know what? Like, we need 10 million now.
And also,
so we will sell you this older guy.
But also, I think as PSR kind of rolls on and becomes like, it will always be a thing. Now, I think people will need to get more inventive in the market.
Sure.
Season on season, being like, we have a hole to fill this season, but we have barely any money to do it. How can we do that? Just to get us through to, like, a season or two from now when we can get the guy we actually want.
Yeah.
I think there'll be a lot more deals like that that happen, like, ongoing, basically, every window from now on, or every summer window from now on, basically.
Cool, man. Well, I expect that we'll see some by the end of the summer, and maybe if they're interesting, we'll review them. Shall we go on to the burn book? Okay, Pete, we got to race through the burn book today.
Yeah.
Burn book time. I'm going to start with what I'm taking out of the burn book because it's boring.
Okay, love it.
But
off to a good start.
I think a lot of people say, you know, that like we all kind of get fucked over by tech companies basically telling us we have to upgrade our tech very, very regularly. And, you know, this idea that you'll get left behind. And I actually think that idea has slid a little bit. There was a time when it felt like everyone would rush to get, like, the new iPhone and the new MacBook and stuff. And now I feel like everyone's like, my phone's like 3 years old. I don't really give a shit. That's fine. So I do think that in some ways we've all taken this on board. But actually, obviously, technology is improving at, like, an insane rate. like it really is.
Well,
and sometimes when you realize that maybe you should go and upgrade your tech, you do get a massive reward. So recently, my laptop was being an absolute prick. I was really struggling with it because, you know, I do a lot of video podcasts, using it, it gets pretty heavily taxed. I run a bunch of peripherals through it when I do that as well. And I was just like, fuck, I think I need to buy a new laptop. This is really annoying. And I thought, God, I haven't even had that laptop for that long. And then I was like, well, I've actually had it for 5 years, which is not crazy long, but it's not a short period of time either when I use it every day.
Certainly not in the tech world either.
Sure. And, but I was kind of a little bit like, is this, like, let's hope this makes things better.
Tax deductible, baby.
But we'll see. Yeah, I do need to deduct the fuck out of my taxes. But I got a new one. I got like a, you know the refurbished Apple, like Apple do refurbished, where it's basically shit that was sent back to them.
Yeah.
So I got like a MacBook Air from this year that's got like 24 gig RAM.
Yeah.
And like, so it went from like 8 to 24. And obviously it's got like fucking more GPA, CPA, all that fucking horseshit.
GPU, CPU,
you know the one. I've been thinking about CPA.
Great point
averages. I've been thinking about CPA today. I've been in meetings about CPA. So yeah, anyway, like, and honestly, it's a fucking revelation.
Yeah.
I started using it for stuff and I was just like, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, just asking it to do something and it does it is so funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas my old laptop was like, maybe I will and maybe I won't. But if I do, it's going to take a while.
It's like that dodgy lock that you need to find this the exact right crook and angle to get it to turn.
Oh, like when my mother-in-law comes here, sometimes she uses the hob to try and like cook my kid like lunch.
Yeah.
And oh my God. Honestly, she will spend 5 minutes just going click, 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 like trying to turn on the gas on the hob. Click, 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 click. Oh.
Is the spark
on? Click, 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 click. No, she just doesn't know how to do it.
Oh, okay.
It's so easy. But you just have to have the knack.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like I never have a problem doing it. I do it first time.
Yeah.
Every single time. Not a problem at all. You have the knack. Like, same thing with this.
Yeah, but also, yeah, you don't want to have to do a rain dance to get a new tab to open every time.
Yeah, but you get used to doing it.
Sure.
And because it happens slowly over time.
Yeah, like, you get used to it.
After 5 years, you're just like, no, that's what everyone has to do. And then someone's like, no, you fucking moron. And again, like, in the same way that there's some technical advances that actually do just like, it doesn't feel like things are getting better, generally speaking. But there was a time where your laptop just didn't have enough storage, you know, where your laptop might have like fucking 32 gig of storage or something insane, you know, like it was super, super low back in the day.
Mm.
And now you're like, the minimum you're looking at is 256. Like that is a basic level. And 256 is actually totally fine for me. I don't keep that much shit on my laptop because I'm not like torrenting porn or whatever. So there are real improvements in that way. Similarly, like my wife and I had I say this like you don't know my wife, Emma and I had had like just a John Lewis espresso machine.
Yeah, yeah.
We got it a few years ago. We were kind of like, maybe we'll get this. We got it from my in-laws.
The one that's in your house now, or was in your house now?
Was in your house.
Okay.
And it did us a few years, you know, like it made perfectly good coffee and it was like very simple and was totally fine. And then recently I was just kind of like, I use this all the time. I'm just going to upgrade this motherfucker. Like, I'm just going to get a good one.
Yeah.
And so I went out and I got one of the Sage, you know, like the Breville Sage, like machines.
Yeah.
And it arrived this morning. And I was futzing around with it while I was trying to run a bath for my kids. So like just making the weirdest coffee.
This evening?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had a decaf. It's fine.
Okay, right.
But I just brewed a coffee and I was like, oh yeah. You can just get things that are better, you know, because I was like, it's expensive. Again, I got it refurbished, you know, because loads of people just return this stuff. And quite often, you know, you buy those things and it's like the condition is good. And sometimes people are like, the one that I got that was good had a big scratch on it. But I always find that if you get one that's good, the condition, you're like, this looks like no one's ever touched this fucking thing. Like, it honestly looks like basically no one's used it.
A subsection of this entry should be, buy refurbished. I got a refurbished iPad for like 40% off. It's perfect.
Yeah.
If you didn't tell me it wasn't new, I wouldn't have known.
I do this with all my phones now. Like my last phone was refurbished and I was just like, if I get a phone that came out like 6 months ago, there's only so much wear it can have on it. And you can look at the battery when it arrives, like look at the battery health and send it back if you don't like it.
It's exactly like our segment of veteran players, Patrick.
It is actually exactly like it. Yeah, though I would say the Apple refurbished thing is different, right? The Apple refurbished thing is normally like 20% off and they are literally barely
used. It's like 98%
efficient. Exactly. Whereas if you go to Backmarket or Reebok or whatever, you are going to get something that's slightly, that has more miles on it, I would say. But like with a coffee machine, I think this is sat in someone's house. You know, yeah. They haven't like fucking like climbed the Himalayas with this thing strapped to their back. Like it's a coffee machine. It sits on a work surface and now it sits on my work surface. And yeah, I guess I was just kind of like, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, 10, 15 years ago would cost, you know, 100, 200 quid.
Yeah.
And now what you'd get for that money is significantly better, I think. Well, similarly, like you can get a shitty espresso machine for 100 quid. And then like 2-3 years later, you can get an espresso machine for 300 quid. It is more, but it is so much better. Like you literally would not believe it. Like the technology has advanced to such an insane degree that like this coffee machine, if I want to, I can make it, if I'm a dickhead, like one of those wankers who talks about pulling shots and all this kind of horseshit. I'm not one of those wankers, but like I could do it all completely manually. I could do it all manually, but there's a touch screen, and if you want, it will just tell you how to make a coffee.
Oh,
and
it'll
make
it.
And it'll make you like a perfectly nice, good coffee, which is great. And it takes no time to heat up. You turn it on and it goes, and then it's warm. It will steam your milk by itself. You just put the milk under it and it just steams it. It monitors the temperature, and when it reaches the right temperature, it's like, your milk's done. It's fucking amazing, man. So what I'm saying is, it's expensive to upgrade your tech. It is. I've spent a lot of money on these two fucking things recently, especially the laptop. Jesus. But sometimes, if you've been suffering for a while, it is worth getting a new one. And we have this iPad that I use, you know, like we rarely use it. I basically use it when I brush my teeth. I balance it on the bath while I brush my teeth and like watch it. But then when we go on holiday with the kids, we take it and I load it up with stuff. But it's now so old. I think it's literally like 9 years old. Yeah. Now it's so old.
It's got like a curved back, one of those ones.
Yeah. And now it's so old as well that like it just doesn't hold charge at all.
Yeah.
I will charge it the night before we go on a trip and I will check it in the morning and be like, have we lost 20%? Like, have we lost 40%? I don't know. And now I'm just kind of like, you can buy an iPad that's basically new for like 180 quid if you're willing to get it refurbished. It's crazy. So if you've got really old shit and you're actually finding that you're wasting your life, like futzing around with it, oh, well, all I need to do is press this just the right way or jiggle this or wait 5 minutes because I've got too many tabs open on my laptop, I would consider getting a new one. After I said I'd be quick, that was not quick.
But I did enjoy it. I do agree. And yeah, refurb, in my opinion, is what
I agree.
My taking out of the burn book is equally as important as the technological advances that you're speaking of there. The thing I'm taking out of the burn book this week are Murgis sausages.
Oh, okay.
Are you familiar with one of society's most incredible inventions?
Yeah, I am familiar. So I mean, not this society's invention,
but
I will
also
say.
Also not the French society's either. But they have really adopted them.
Yeah, but
they're
but
very North African, right?
Yeah, that's a North African thing, right?
Yeah. So if you're unfamiliar with Murgis sausages, they're basically these kind of like spicy pork chipolatas that have been adopted seamlessly into French culture.
Traditionally, are they not lamb?
Are they lamb?
I think traditionally they're lamb for exactly the reason that we've just discussed, because they're North African.
That's a very good point.
And so they are consumed by Muslims. I believe that...
Oh, lamb beef or a mixture of lamb. Yeah, no, you're right. You're correct.
That's my understanding of the Murgis.
Every time I see a sausage, I'm just like, it's probably pork, isn't it?
I mean, probably. I imagine that in France, a bunch of French people are like, why do we not simply make this with pork? Given their extreme consideration for Muslims in France.
Yeah. Especially when you buy, or in my opinion, the better versions of them are the cheaper pre-packed, like, supermarket ones. The dodgy sausages. For whatever reason, don't know what it is, but once they hit the barbecue, it's just symphony of excellence. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Murgis sausages. We were obviously just in France. Everywhere you go, any supermarket you walk into, there will be Murgis sausages available to buy in France. And there's something, the thing that just reminds me of my childhood holidays, and they just absolutely slap. So you can get a packet of like six of them. I would happily eat all six of those sausages and more in a single sitting. Because also, like, they're long and skinny. Sure. So they, like, because they're so skinny, they don't feel like real sausages. And two, like, the spice on them is always perfect. You stick them on the barbecue. You can char them in oblivion and they'll still taste good. Like, you don't need to cook them even that well and they're still just elite. Every time you go to France, the one thing I look forward to the most are the fact that Merguez sausages are so readily available everywhere. You chuck them on the barbecue every single night, never get bored of them. To the extent where we've now been home for a week and a bit, week and a half. I have multiple times Googled this. I've searched the phrase Merguez sausages in London. The market isn't great, I'll be honest, Patrick.
Really? I feel like you can get anywhere.
You can get them. The Google search options didn't bode very well for being in Zone 5 South. It was very like...
Is there not like a halal butcher or something near you that would probably do you like a fucking elite Merguez?
I've never seen Merguez on offer anywhere in like butchers or anything.
Mm, okay.
Like I really do think they're quite a specialist thing in Britain, but they're so common in France. And like,
we were so
rushed in leaving because we drove to France. We were so rushed in leaving. We didn't bring any wine home. We didn't bring any cheese home.
Oh my God.
And we didn't bring any Merguez sauce. We didn't bring any French sweets home or French crisps as well. Actually, no, tell a lie. We brought two packets of bread crisps home, but that was just like travel crisps that we didn't eat.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we really, really left a lot out there. But Merguez sausages, if you haven't tried them and you come across them, do not hesitate. Buy them, chuck them on the grill. You will not be disappointed. They're unbelievable.
They are good. They are good. Undeniably delicious. Okay, on to what we're putting in the burn book. Quick one from me. Actually, quick. British summer.
Okay.
People playing music on speakers in public places.
Mm.
Shirtless men wandering down the street, stinking.
Yeah.
Maroon cunts everywhere. It's British summertime. Like, there is maybe no nation on earth which believes that it is a summertime nation with less reason than Britain. People here love the summer. They are uniquely poorly equipped for the summer because they're pasty and stupid. All they do is lie in the sun and get heat stroke.
Yeah.
I feel like everyone in the UK is like 20% more of a twat as soon as the temperature ticks above 25 degrees. And it doesn't help that I'm always pissed off when it starts to get hot. But also, I just get angry looking at people like baking in the sun who are just going a colour where they should be seriously concerned about themselves.
Mm.
And as well, there's just like drinking fucking hot tea in the summer and stuff. I just look at these people and I'm like, you guys are twats. Like, I know that that's the thing that's done in other places. Like, don't come at me, India. But like, I just think the British are like a very... They love that they have this like romantic idea of the summertime, but the actual summertime they all fantasize about, they flock to the beach in droves. They behave like pricks when they're there. They drop a load of litter. You go to ice cream vans now, and quite often they're like, they have a picture of something that looks like a Mr. Whippy, but it's not actually a Mr. Whippy. It's like bullshit, like somehow fake Mr. Whippy.
You know,
like the actual, sometimes you get one, but often the ice cream, they're like, yeah, it's actually different from Mr. Whippy. And it's like, yeah, I can tell. Because it sucks.
I've not had a Mr. Whippy in 20 years.
Bro, I love a Mr. Whippy. But yeah, until like a couple of summers ago, I don't think I'd had one for many, many years as well. Yeah. But I will always get one if I can get one. Yeah. I'm a big fan. But yeah, I don't know. I just think Britain in the summertime, horrible place to be. Like, nothing functions.
Oh my God, the train tracks get too hot. The train tracks get too hot.
They're like, trains can't run. And you're like, oh right, yeah, because I forgot that this is the hottest country in the world.
Yeah.
The train track can't run.
Our aircon's broke because we're using it too much. Oh, what, the 4 weeks a year that is required is too much for this aircon unit to cope.
And if you tell a British person, especially an older one, that you've got an aircon unit, then they're just like, those are really expensive to run. Really expensive.
Do you know what's more expensive? A funeral.
And they're like... But they're just like, you know how expensive those things are to run. It's like, I don't like cost it out because I'm not a fucking dweeb. But like, yeah, like I get this expensive to run. Yeah, those are so expensive. It's just like, yeah, but what I used to do is like 3 weeks of the year, I would not sleep. You know?
You suffer.
Yeah, you just lie there and you were sticky and you were miserable and it sucked. And now I'm like, just put on the aircon unit, went to bed in 22 degrees. Mm. It was completely fine. Woke up feeling great. like no difference at all this kind of shit. Like, I don't know, I just hate this country. And yeah, like what you're saying there, I think some people who don't live here, I think, would be shocked by that, the fact that happens. But yeah. I was explaining it to Rishi, who I work with on the transfer flow recently, where I was just like, he's in Texas. And I was like, in the UK, when it's too windy, trains don't run.
Yeah.
When it's too hot, trains don't run. When it snows, trains don't run.
Yeah.
Like,
when it's too wet, sometimes trains don't run.
There's literally no weather in which the trains function perfectly, except like sort of gray sky, not that warm, not raining too much. Like there's this Goldilocks zone where they were like, Britain will always be like this, and therefore the trains will run. It's like other countries get hotter, get colder, and yet the trains run. And yet in the UK, they're just like, you can't run a train if it snowed recently. Also, that's insane. You're like, what do you think they do in Russia?
for a country to get all four seasons in a week, you think we'd be better equipped to deal with all of those four seasons?
Absolutely not.
But yeah, no, I fully agree that British summertime does absolutely bring out the worst in people. I literally got on a train yesterday, coming from work, and I got on the carriage, and I just knew it was going to be a grim trip, because standing in front of me was a topless man, absolutely battered, with a bottle of Stella, and I was like,
I bet he fucking stank.
He always stank of booze. And then he also went up and down the carriage trying to make conversation with people and was complaining about how everybody had AirPods in. Everybody put AirPods in because they didn't want to fucking listen to him.
Yeah, exactly. It's just not a coincidence, man.
I was like, oh my God, this guy. Like, he was so pissed as well. And I was like, this guy's literally been out in the sun. He's standing topless on like a crowded commuter train home. The lack of awareness is staggering. Staggering. But yeah. Very representative of British summertime.
But they're all just like, I love the summer, me. I love it. I love the sun. I'm a sun worshipper. No, you're not. You're a stupid fuck. Like, your parents are cousins. Like, you're a moron. Anyway, like, right. Yeah, British summertime, not a fan.
Big agreement. What am I putting in the burn book this week? What I'm going to put in the burn book, simple one, because it literally happened yesterday and it fucking pissed me off to no end. Stubbing your toe. There is little worse that is still like not tragic in the world than stubbing your toe, because it sits on this weird graph of almost a reasonable and instant amount of pain. It's not so sore that your body goes into shock or there's adrenaline takes over that you don't feel it. You feel it instantly and immediately. Sure. And it's like, it is incredibly painful. But it also goes from 0 to 100 for frustration as well. Because I've never seen anybody who's stubbed their toe and not been immediately furious that they've stubbed their toe. Like, I could cut my finger with like a knife chopping whatever. And I'd be like, ah, fuck. You know, I wouldn't be like immediately furious about it. I'd be like, that is sore.
Yeah.
That is unfortunate. As soon as you stub your toe, like, I've gone from zero to, like, rage has gone from 0 to 100. Pain, like comprehensible pain, goes from 0 to 100. But it hasn't passed the threshold where your body goes into shock or like really kind of kicks in those like supernatural ability to deal with like an immense amount of pain or you feel it later or whatever. And it always happens. It always happens when you're in a rush or when you're in a bad mood or at like the least opportune time. So I was getting ready for work yesterday morning. I was like 25 minutes late, as usual. It's a personality trait. And I was just about ready to go and I was about to put socks on, put my shoes on. And we have this fucking cat scratching post that sits outside our bedroom so the cat doesn't scratch other things on the middle floor. But the base of it is like half an inch wider than where the door frame starts. And as you walk in the door, your left baby toe is just prime position for catching that bad boy, which is also wedged into the corner of the wall, so it doesn't move. Like, as soon as you catch that, it just melts your toe. And I like fully split my baby toe open Tuesday morning. Well, like, I mean, like right by the nail. I was like,
oh God.
Immediate blood. Just as I was trying to leave the house to go to work.
Jesus.
And I was just like, are you fucking kidding? So initially I was like, that is fucking sore. I am now absolutely fuming. It's like 8:30 in the morning. Oh, and now there's blood. So I'm like, I need to put on socks and Birkenstocks because it was a warm day.
Of course.
Is that going to bleed through my sock? I'm putting a plaster. I'm fishing through the fucking medicine drawer to find plasters at 8:34 on a Tuesday morning so I can patch up my bleeding toe from the fucking cat post. And it's just, for something that's so simple, for something that's so like, oh, you've banged your foot against something, there shouldn't be that much pain and there shouldn't be that much annoyance. And I have absolutely zero time for stubbing your toe.
Look, I can't argue with it. Like, it sucks because it's also embarrassing.
Yeah.
And you don't get sympathy. Like, if Emma came home and I'd cut my finger open with a knife, she'd be like, oh my God, are you okay? Yeah. But if I said I stubbed my toe and it really hurts, she'd be like, you fucking pussy. Like, get a grip. And also, I think it's one of those things like rolling your ankle where it's so painful when it happens and you're literally like in agony. Mm. And then 2 minutes later, it doesn't hurt at all. And you're really embarrassed about what a fucking massive fuss
you
made of it.
But you're still annoyed about it.
Yeah, even though, of course, everybody knows it's really painful. It's the same way that in a football match, you know, sometimes someone like basically gets a kick on the ankle. They go down and they're rolling around. Everyone's like, look, this guy, he's faking it. And then 2 minutes later, he gets up and everyone's like, look, he's fine. And you're like, yeah, but actually, if you roll your ankle, yeah, you do kind of feel like you've been shot in the ankle. And then 2 minutes later, you are fine. Like, that is actually how that works. Yeah, I agree. It's embarrassing. Like, wait till you get some of the really... When you get like, when you're using high chairs more.
Yeah, we just bought one.
And then there are the wooden ones, the stocker ones. We have two of those. Like those, because...
Are those the like shelf ones?
Yeah. And because with those, like normally, right, with the legs of the chairs, legs of a chair slightly flare outwards usually.
Yeah, that's the one we've bought. Yeah.
But there's the leg of the chair that's kind of like 2 feet off the ground and you can see it go down to the bit of the ground, the bit that is furthest out. You know, so as in, you know where it is because you can see the whole leg. Whereas with this, there's a bit at the bottom that just juts out at the back that is actually attached at the front. You know, there's kind of an L shape,
yeah.
wooden bit. And so you just walk straight into it. Like it's literally 2 inches off the ground. So it's just at the height that it's going to fucking destroy your foot. But you've kind of got no way to anticipate it because it looks like there's nothing there when you're just walking. I absolutely batter my feet on those at least twice a week, and when it happens, well, I felt better today because I was talking to some parents from my kids' nursery, and one of them was saying like, yeah, like Bonnie was going around the other day just saying dickhead like all the time because she heard her dad say it about a kid who lived next door. And I was like, well, Coco says Jesus Christ, she said dickhead the other day, she said it really beautifully. She said twat the other day because I described one of the dads of another kid at her nursery as a twat. But every time I stub my foot on this, we get dangerously close to the first time she says cunt.
Yeah.
I think she said every swear word at this point except for cunt.
I mean, she said
fuck recently.
I cannot wait until my child starts swearing. Like, so, as bad as stubbing your toe is, the inverse of that is your child swearing.
I agree.
There is just no world where it's not funny.
I agree. And I think it's like weirdly fucking uptight when people care about it. I think it's like fear of their parents disapproving or whatever. But objectively, a kid saying fuck is funny. And if and if you got called into school and they were like, well, your kid said fuck, I'd be like, well, that is a word that adults use.
Yeah.
And I get that like she shouldn't use it in class when she's six.
Yeah.
But it's not that surprising that she's heard the word, and it's not that surprising that she wants to use it.
Yeah.
In the same way that she wants to talk to me about like space shuttles or a rhino. You know, like she doesn't know what, she's never seen those fucking things either, but she's interested in the word, you know? So of course, when I say like, look at this stupid fuck, thinking my kid's not listening, of course she's then like, Papa, what is stupid fuck? And I'm like, there's a long answer to a very straightforward question, really.
Yeah.
All right. I think that takes us to the end of the Burn Book for this week. We're going to catch a bunch of you over on the paid side. Thank you to everybody who's been listening. We really do appreciate you. Continue to send your questions in. Hopefully, the transfer window is about to go bananas. I kind of feel like with some of the striker dominoes about to fall, like looks like Arsenal making a move, Liverpool linked with Ekitike, like we might get some chaos. So catch up with us and we will be covering it all. We will see you next time. Bye bye.